That's the only thing they got buried, right?
Huh?
That's the only footage they got of Charlie Parker. They have very little. There's one piece that I've seen. Oh, yeah, the piece with you and Bird and what's the left-handed drummer?
Charlie. Charlie,
what do I do about this? Do it's a turning
now. Give me five. Give me some scanner, that stuff out of date. Well, that changes so fast, I'll have to look at the electrician Zombie to find out about it.
Anyway, you got the awards, and it's really quite an event.
Well, it's quite an event in two senses, actually, because, you know, in the music business, we've been practicing brotherhood for quite a long time. Man's color and his religion don't make any difference. I mean, put an horn in his hands, the only thing.
The fellow was young. What year was that?
The thing about the Down Beach All American Band, it makes it
you
all
know, Earl Wilson.
Different.
You know
him. Ah, that's who that is.
Right. Well, how about it? How are we going to get rid of these now?
I've been used to doing this for quite a while. Maybe it'd be a nice change if I turn it over to you, let you do the honors.
I'd love to. Charlie, did we? Well, here they are. This is Charlie Parker.
It's indeed a great pleasure to meet you.
Leonard says I'm supposed to be the toastmaster of the tour of the Georgie Jeff.
Baby, look at you, dear.
So, Charlie, I want to award you now the Downbeat Award for the best alto sax man of 1951. Congratulations, Ben. And this is to you from Downbeat for being one of the top trumpet men of all time. Congratulations, Diz. I mean, Dizzy, I got a little informal. You boys got anything more to say?
Well, Earl, they say music speaks louder than words, so we'd rather voice our opinion that way.
Think that'd be all right with everybody? You really want to do it?
Okay,
now
all
you fellas are getting something here.
Yeah, he did.
I better tell them that we're going to have some really torrid tempo with Charlie Parker, the alto sax, and Diz at the trumpet, and Dick Hyman's at the piano. They're going to play
Dick Hyman.
Hot House. Okay, fellas, let's go.
Go ahead on, Earl. Oh, this is the film, dude.
What, this ain't called Rubber?
Now, tell me this.
Hot House.
Are y'all really playing Hot House with this a record? Somebody told me this was a record. This is the record.
I'm fingering it.
Who's that, Teddy Kodak on bass?
Oh, yeah, I don't know who he is.
Charlie, is not Charlie Smith. What is it?
Charlie Smith.
That's his name, yeah.
No.
Who is that?
I forgot his name.
Yeah, see, that's why I'm saying it had to be a record because you wasn't playing. Face,
left-handed too.
That's all you use in those days, snare drum.
Well, neither one of us remember the bass player. Well, we know all the rest of them. Mm-hmm. We know Leonard Feather, and we know, what's the other guy's name?
Earl Wilson.
Earl Wilson, yeah. Earl Wilson has, the newsman on the left has, for many years, he had a column in the Daily News in New York. And they hired him to do the show, I guess.
At the time, you didn't play with your usual trumpet now?
I hadn't got it at that time. That was the kind of what I was playing at that time. This hadn't happened.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the drummer, Max?
He's very good. In fact, Charlie Smith is now a lawyer. He's not playing music anymore. He's an attorney. A brilliant, brilliant young man. You know, he was one of the younger drummers that came on the scene. I just asked Dizzy, I said, Dizzy, why didn't I have that gig? He said, I don't know. I don't know where I was at that time. But
you must not have been in New York.
Yeah, but that is a very, very important film. I think that's one of the very few things that Charlie Parker was on. We actually see and hear the few words. But Dizzy was also commenting about Charlie Parker's, his vocabulary. His vocabulary was expansive. He would sound like a professor, you know, all the words and all that.
Like one time, when we were with Earl Hines, I was in intermission. I always fool around with the piano, you know, on the piano. Intermission. This is a white dance. That was so some guy walked up to the piano and thumped a penny, a nickel, a dime up to the piano and said, play His Eyes on the Sparrow or something. I don't know what the hell he was playing.
You Are My
what
Sunshine.
Yeah. Tennessee Waltz or something. This was in Arkansas, Pine Bluff, Arkansas. So I looked when he threw the money down there. I just did that and kept going. I didn't pay him any mind. So afterwards, we had to wait. See, we were waiting around for the guy to pack up the stuff, and I had to go to the toilet. So I thought everybody was gone. I looked out in there. There was nobody out in the ballroom. So I went in the toilet and came out. And when I walked out of the toilet, this guy had a bottle of, bam, hit me in the head. And blood came all out on my uniform. And so I reached at the table outside. There was a big bottle out there. I was getting a guy, and they grabbed me. And then Charlie Parker came up and said to the guy that hit me, say, you took advantage of my friend, you cur. A cur is a dog in English. You call him a cur. The first time I'd heard that word, I thought it was proper.
It was very proper. But I think the background of the story was that we were playing a segregated dance.
Oh, yes.
It was a segregated dance, and he went, when he thought everybody was gone, he went to the toilet that was exclusively for white people only. When he came out, then the man struck him. I mean, what the story is about. And Charlie Parker, of course, in very proper English, said, you hit my friend, you cur. Yeah. That's
I'll never forget that, man. I you know, all this blood now, I mean, but I thought it was funny then, man.
Do these kind of things cross your mind when you're playing? I mean, especially in a tribute to Charlie Parker.
What?
Do you have these images, all these memories? Do they cross your mind when you're playing in a tribute to Charlie Parker, all these things?
Well, for me personally, the tribute to Charlie Parker is really a chance to play with some of the greatest musicians that came out of the United States of America, and especially Mr. Gillespie. But I guess when you might say what Charlie Parker meant to all of us, many of us, was that he had a brilliant, brilliant mind, and he exemplified what black people are in general. You know, there are a lot of Charlie Parkers out here, Dizzy Gillespie's and things like that. And that's what he really means. His brilliance here exemplified just that fact of how you could survive in the United States and have fun with it, I think, too, and accomplish something. Mm-hmm. Really accomplish something phenomenal.
And bring something new to the music.
Yeah.
Because Charlie Parker was the architect of the style. So everybody, all the young musicians wanted to play like that, including me, including Miles, including Fat Girl, including Kennedy. All of us had the phrasing. The phrasing is the most important part of Charlie Parker music. Because if you were to write it down, what he played, it would not sound like that. But the way that he attacked this one and go to another two notes and play it smoothly and then attack, you know, the way that he played, that was the way. So I think we would call him the architect. I don't know what you would call me, but just call me.
it was a great period for us down on 52nd Street, at least for me. I came there, and to have been in the middle of people like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk and that trio, I think, was significant for us who came to 52nd Street or to Harlem during that period. When I say us, I'm talking about folks like Bud Powell and Fats Navarro and Miles Davis.
Kenny Dorham.
We all came to New York because of Dizzy and Charlie Parker. They were the, and Monk, who had that special thing too. But that was the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. You know, the holy triumvirate, who were really the architects of that new of what happened during that period, the music of Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, which just set off a whole new thing. It's difficult for them to talk about, especially him to talk about it. But Dizzy was the first one who introduced those of us who were in New York, the younger musicians, to people like Charlie Parker and Oscar Pettiford. I mean, he just brought all these wonderful folks and started it. And of course, the biggest thrill for me when I came on the scene was when Dizzy Gillespie called me to work in his band. And the first band that his dream band never did was really realized, because the first band we had on 52nd Street, I think it was 1943, Dizzy, His band was Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, Oscar Pettiford, and myself. And that band never did materialize.
No.
And then later, of course, we did work together on 52nd Street when he sent me a telegram. I was in California with Benny Carter and said that he was opening up a club in New York City and Charlie Parker was in the band. But the first time I met Bird was with Victor Coulson, the trumpet player who loved Dizzy. He, Charlie Parker, came to New York, and we were working in the 78th Street Tap Room, and also Monroe's Uptown House. We worked, see, in those days, you worked 7 nights a week in White Town, that was downtown. And you worked 7 nights a week in Blacktown, that was Uptown. The Uptown clubs were called illegitimate, and the downtown were legitimate, only because the hours for the downtown club was 9 p.m. to 3 a.m. in the morning, and then we'd go up to Harlem and play from 4 a.m. in the morning until
the sun
would come up, and even then after. And that's when I was, you know, these were the two clubs. We worked 7 days a week. We were on the stand 12, 14 hours a day. And so when Charlie Parker came to New York from Kansas City, he joined that little band we had for Monroe, for Clark Monroe.
Because he didn't belong to the union.
Right, and he could play with us because this was an illegitimate band, so to speak. So Clark Monroe, of course, was Billie Holiday's brother-in-law, and he had an after-hours club. And when we play at that club, after you left Menton's, when Dizzy and them would come in town, and Lester Young and all these folks, when they'd come in town, they would sometimes jam at Menton's, but they would also come to the after-hours spots.
That's right, those were the two places.
To Monroe's Uptown House. Yeah. And that's, so when I first met Charlie Parker, it was in that scene. And Victor Coulson came to the club one night and said, tomorrow night, I'm gonna bring down one of the greatest musicians that ever lived. So, you know, we're in New York. We played, we heard everybody. We heard Lester Young, Charlie Coleman, Hawkins, Don Byers. And so we said, well, okay. And Charlie Parker came in that the next night he brought him in, and that's when he joined the band. Mm-hmm. And he played, and, you know, he was very modest. He was humble. He played, and we said, yeah, he's one of the bad dudes. You know, we didn't realize it. That time, at least I didn't. What was happening until you made us more aware, but Victor Coulson knew. And, you know, we just played for him and everything. We played shows, you know. You had to play for chorus girls. You had to play for
blues singers.
And then you played, then the band would play maybe two or three tunes as a solo spot. And that solo spot that night, Victor Coulson, who was the straw boss of the band, had Charlie Parker play a solo, and he played Cherokee. It was interesting. And then
before that time, we thought Cherokee belonged to Don Byers.
Right.
Until we heard Charlie Parker play it. Don Byers was a man, real fast girl, and he played Cherokee. But when Charlie Parker came on the scene, the way that he played, they said, well, no one has heard Cherokee that way.
That was a kind of crazy period, a time of fire, as you said once or something. It was, everything was boiling. And
yes.
Yeah, everything was really.
I've often wondered this, that during that period, there had to be some kind of phenomena. There had to be a phenomenon that everybody came to New York City. During that period, of course, you were bringing people to New York. You would say, come to New York, Oscar Pettiford. And of course, Bud and myself, we were already in New York. And you would come to New York from Philadelphia.
Yeah, I was in 37, yeah.
Yeah, and we used to rehearse up to Dizzy's house. Dizzy lived right in the center of Harlem, the middle of it, where you walk out your house and there was always music. You know, the after-hour clubs were around the corner. And of course, Diz was, at that time, was writing and working with, not only with Cab, but just about everybody, but Boyd Rayburn and everything during that period.
Yeah, he was picking up extra money.
Yeah, yeah. And
Woody Herman. Jimmy Dorsey.
There was another thing about the musicians of that period, and Charlie Parker exemplified that too, that knocked me out, was that they never overplayed. You know, they would always leave, and when it's like last night, when Diz plays, you don't want him to stop. But they would give you just enough to want more. What did Lester Young call it? Don't over. don't overextend your welcome or something. But like just that. Enough so that you always want more. You always leave somebody wanting some more. And I know Miles and I, when he formed that band that we worked with him, man, every night we would wait. We would say, well, why did he play such a short? Why was his solo so short? Because he always wanted to hear more. He always left that feeling that...
That's as well what happened yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, you want more to be said. Yeah, the musicians, yeah, that was nice.
The spirit is still alive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it'll be here a long time, right around the spirit. Mm-hmm. You see the two alto saxophonists, they were twins last night.
Yeah, wasn't that nice?
Yeah, well, Phil Woods and
Jackie McLean.
Jackie McLean. That one, it just went on and on. It was beautiful.
They really enjoyed
Both of them are students of Charlie Parker.
During our discussion, you spoke about the democratic aspects of jazz, and this appeared as well yesterday during the rehearsal when you all discussed what you would play and who would play and when, all this. Do you always work that way?
Yeah, for example.
Performance.
Yeah, so you pick special people, right? When Dizzy wanted that band, with Charlie Parker and Bud Powell and Oscar Pettiford and myself, and it was because he had listened to everybody and knew that these were the people that he could deal with. So when he would write something like Night in Tunisia, he'd give us the essence of the piece, so to speak, in music. He'd, you know, but then he'd give us the freedom to also be creative, as long as we respected the character of the music itself. But that's what this music is about. It's you get people together and they collectively are involved in the creativity, even though, say, the thought comes out of maybe one individual. Like we played Charlie Parker's music, played some of his music last night. And there's a certain attitude that that music has, a certain character that that music has that you respect, but you come to it with your own way of dealing with it. I know that when we would have record dates, he would usually write just one part for Miles, for the trumpet, and he'd transpose to the alto saxophone for his part. He only wrote one part. He'd tell the pianist and the bass player the chordal progressions, the harmony. He'd say, well, you know, it's outside as I got rhythm, and maybe the bridge is honeysuckle rose or something like that. And he'd look at me and say, and you know what to do. And this is the way we record. And we'd go into the studio in those days and do a whole album in maybe 3 hours. We were just discussing how during that period, the first big band before Billy Eckstein's band was your band.
That's right.
Dizzy's first big band. And I'll never forget that, because Dizzy took care of me like I was... Lorraine got angry because I was so messed up. She said, is he but in any case, that first big band we had and we played the Bronx, who was in that band?
All up there. Miles, Kenny Dunn, I don't know who the
was Freddie Webster in it?
Freddie Webster. And
Fats? Was Fats in that band, the first one?
I don't think so. I don't think he was in that.
And the Reed section had?
The boy from Brooklyn, the tenor player.
Ray Abrams. Right.
Maybe Cecil Payne might have been in that band. Up in that theater up in the Bronx.
Yeah, I remember that.
Ooh, man. We played this arrangement. I made arrangements on I Should Care.
Yeah.
And I had a solo there. And I gave the solo to Freddie.
I remember.
Webster. Yeah. He killed. I never played that solo no more. I just erased it out of the band after he left.
played it.
Well then, Max, you were not in the band with Charlie Parker, Ren Dizzy, the one we saw.
Yes.
But do you remember something about this picture and this band? This picture was published in 1988.
Oh yeah, this was the first band that Dizzy, Don Byas and George Wallington, the piano player and the tenor saxophone, were substitutes for Charlie Parker and Bud Powell.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
His first choice was Charlie Parker, who was where? He was in Kansas City. He was in Kansas City, and George and Bud Powell, of course. His family thought that Dizzy was too advanced.
Thought I was nuts. In other words.
Yeah, that was the first band. That was our first band. That was a good band. I would leave. We would finish playing, and you would be just so excited and so full of what's happening because all the music was fresh and new. We should play, I was thinking about, we didn't play Woody and You last night, so we're gonna play them things.
Yeah, they know that.
Yeah, they know that. We'll play some of those things. First time I heard Around Midnight and
oh, man.
Woody and You and...
In that band?
Yeah, he was writing it. That music was...
We played all them.
They had a completely school, they had... Diz had like a school in New York because we would rehearse up to his apartment at 2040 7th Avenue every day. Every musician would come up during the day to his place. And
do you think the way of working among musicians has changed? This kind of community?
Well, in New York now, they don't have to have a ID card to play in a club.
That's interesting. That was interesting. Now, this is very interesting.
We had to have everybody that played in a club that sold alcohol had to go through the police department. And if you had any kind of a record or anything, no play. That was is an impediment to a lot of musicians because a lot of musicians got arrested or something like that. So that was one of the things. And then they had little bands all over though. That came later when they passed a law in New York where the band couldn't be more than two pieces, something like piano and bass or something like that. But now it's different now. They got that you can have a full quintet or whatever.
That was an interesting phenomenon during that same period. I had forgotten about that. But you had to go to the police department and be fingerprinted, you know? They take your hand and fingerprint you like this. And you have to take a picture like a criminal. And then you could work in a nightclub. So it's as Dizzy said, it did inhibit many, many musicians. Not many, many, but it inhibits some of the important musicians that might have had a skirmish with the law because maybe drugs or whatever, something like that.
Did that apply to all musicians or only black musicians?
All musicians. Frank Sinatra couldn't get a card.
Yeah, he wouldn't play in New York.
He wouldn't play in New York.
Yeah. He could have gotten one, but he wouldn't do it because of that.
Because, yeah. It was an insult. Yeah. But he's got a point, though. It did affect us, mainly. Mm-hmm.
Everything affected us because we were on the end of everything.
Yeah.
Yes, Kenny Clarke once said that if there was that you had said that if there was a message in your music, it was get out of that shit.
If there was a...
that's Kenny Clarke who said that Dizzy had said that.
If there was
a message. That was the message of your music.
Oh, I had that, yes. In fact, Charlie Parker had said that.
Oh.
I remember when Dizzy, who was closer to Charlie Parker perhaps than anybody that I know of, when he is musical, creative giants, Dizzy. But I remember when Dizzy and the rest of us, of course, was chastising Charlie Parker about finally he get his health together, because everybody in the world loved him and respected him. And Charlie Parker's answer was that it's immaterial or incidental that he's the kind of musician he is, but his main purpose for being on the earth was to prove that if you use drugs, that it would destroy you. And this is the way he had the kind of mind that would justify every action he did. You know, he kind of got away with it. But that's something what you're saying made a lot of sense. But that is, that has nothing to do with it.
Is it still true?
Of course, you know, a lot of people might think, oh, well, let me start again. I think that what because of the social political situation, because of
racial
situations, and because of everything that in the community that we came up in the United States, when you listen to a person like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, Kenny Clarke, and folks like that, they created something that was phenomenal in spite of the conditions that they had to deal with. There was no help. Nobody gave you anything. It was always pressure. And we realize it now when we listen to this, to the music. And of course, I guess last night working for this festival here exemplifies that. Really does, you know. It means a great deal for us that people are listening to us from here, like our director was telling us, from here, and not from here. He says it's the music, you know, it has nothing to do with where sometimes in the States, it's this first, and this is incidental, that's incidental. So I think I would say that Europe has been like an oasis at times when we needed a breath of fresh air and a cool drink of water.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right.